Good afternoon. Next time we have a guest speaker, but this afternoon I'm going to spend the time on going through a few topics, beginning with bad driving out good. So, grab a piece of paper. Write down the first one or two news items you've heard or read recently that come to mind. Discussing it with your neighbour at this point is not helpful. Okie dokie, so starting up front here, excuse me, what news items did you think of? Drink driving, bad drivers, okay, Zika virus. Refugees. More refugees, or should I say less?
Donald Trump.
Would you say Donald Trump's a good news or a bad news story? Bad news stories at the back.
Donald Trump.
Would you say that's a good news or bad news? Neutral, okay. Anyone thought of good news stories? Not a single person? Perfect demo. More sophisticated class would have understood what it was about. This is a cheap demo that worked quite well in introductory classes, where you get people to write down news items, and generally the bad massively outweigh the good news items. Of course, that's often a reflection not of the audience but of the news channel selection. But the theme of this review paper, Baumeister's review paper, is that humans have a tremendous predisposition to allow bad items of all kinds in many areas of psychology to outweigh good items by, 4 to 1 or something. So, why this is relevant is, of course, because quite a lot of positive psychology, and certainly Seligman, takes the view that we're prone to pessimism and need to take active measures to stop our thoughts being ridiculously slanted towards the negative, and therefore it's of interest to look at phenomena related to that. That's the relevance of this course. I find myself deeply resisting Baumeister's conclusions, but I may be the only person in the universe who does that. So you've been warned. I'm going to have a go at convincing you, but judging by past experience, I'll fail. It's a very impressive looking review because it covers so many different areas of psychology, discusses findings, and produces an argument in almost all cases for them being showing evidence of us weighting bad things a lot more strongly than good things. So, did you get lectures on Gottman, on his work on relationships? Did you or didn't you? No? Okay. He's an American. He's done work on videoing couples talking to each other, and he says you can pretty much predict the chance of them breaking up depending on the ratio of positive and negative things they say to each other. Of course, he's only an American. He seems to take no account of possible cultural differences. And certainly, among different groups of young people, you'll find great differences in the microculture about whether they like to, however you want to put it, tease each other with negative comments, or on the contrary, are polite and gentle with each other. And it seems to me that, generally speaking, how we take a comment depends on our expectations. That if the relentless tone of banter is always negative and then someone says something complimentary, that will stand out in a way that if the convention is about being polite and avoiding negative things, would have a different kind of force. Certainly watching mainstream lowbrow Hollywood movies, it depicts American families as repeating "I love you" to their children, to their spouses, several times a day, and it's clear if you were expecting to hear that 10 times a day and then you stopped hearing it, you'd pick up a signal, but that doesn't, that might just be a very local ratio signal. That would be just one of these, one of the ways in which these attempts to have quantitative arguments seem to me not necessarily general. Now, Brickman had a go at looking at big life events, and part of the study was, so he looked at people who'd lost a limb in a car accident, he looked at people who'd won the lottery and were suddenly unspeakably wealthy when they hadn't been before. He also looked at how much it, how happy they seemed to be, and then went back a year later. One of the interesting findings is how people seem to, I mean, a big result might take a year, but people seem to go back actually to the level of happiness they tended to have before. So if you're a naturally optimistic person, you won't like losing a leg, but a year later you might in fact be almost back to the same level. Conversely, if you take someone who's a grouch, they might be pleased at winning the lottery, but they'll be back to feeling grumpy again after a while. So that's one of the things. But nevertheless, there's a difference in impact, at least Baumeister wants to argue that. And his claim is that positive things like winning the lottery have much less impact than losing a leg. However, in this study, as in so many others, I don't think they're able normally to compare like to like. Losing a leg just isn't like winning the lottery. Particularly for most of us who aren't in serious need. You see, if you took refugees who are actually starving in the siege in Syria, they would probably think winning the lottery, provided they could spend it on food, actually was really important. The rest of us, it would be about being more luxurious. It wouldn't be about solving a fundamental problem of the same kind. It seemed to me Baumeister could more appropriately ask people whether what they would choose if the choice was between having neither of those events or both of them. And still that question might lead to people thinking the bad was more than the good, but to me that could equally be interpreted as actually that study hadn't succeeded in finding events of the same kind of impact, objectively even. So the thing about money is it's only when you've got definitely too little for basic needs that it gets really serious. Losing a leg is going to change your everyday habits, so there are a number of ways in which those seem quite different. First of all, you can't really, well, money would be handy for getting the very latest prosthetic, but few people so far actually think they're just as well off with the latest prosthetic device as they were with their original leg. The other way of looking at it would be in terms of control over your life. So the trouble with losing a leg or being an invalid of every kind is you instantly and without any choice have to change a lot of your life right now. So you're forced into changes. Whereas if you win a lot of money, you generally don't absolutely have to change. You may choose to, but on the whole it gives you more choices, not less. And we know pretty much from issues of self-efficacy and so on that people on the whole prefer more choice, not less, and in particular don't like having choices they used to have taken away from them. So they're not actually comparable in that way. Other studies look at emotions, and in particular they'll ask people to write down the names of a dozen emotion words, and typically people recall, or in such an exercise, more words for negative emotions than they do for positive emotions. But I think, again, you have to ask about two things, really. One is, and this is point number one, it seems to be that where we are in our culture in this year, we're a long way from want. In fact, we've got about as much as we need in some sense. That means we, as a psychologist would put it, we're near ceiling for dealing with our needs. That means any change is either not going to make much difference or it's going to be negative. So a psychologist would call that being at ceiling. So I think that means that if a change, so if you go with the theory, which I tend to go with, that emotions are responses to unexpected events, you'd expect us to have more negative and positive emotions because of our state, but we wouldn't expect that to be a human universal. In fact, it's probably only in the last less than 100 years since that's been true of most people. The second kind of argument is again a cultural one, which is, in our culture, do your friends want to listen to you going on about how great their life is, or do they rather listen to you going on about how bad their life is? I think to a considerable extent, I have the sense that people have only about 5 or 10 seconds appetite for listening to how great my life is. They prefer, then they start to take it as rubbing their faces in something they don't have. Whereas it's emotionally safer to talk about problems I have, because a lot of people then relax and they'll be sympathetic, but they'll also feel that they're not in such a bad way if this person's got problems. Now that isn't, I don't think that's universal, I think that's about local culture, I don't think all cultures are like that. So I would expect frequency of discussion of good versus bad things to vary culturally rather than be a psychological universal. And from there, I would just say that on a simple recall task like words for emotion, got to think about practice effects. Which emotions have you had cause to name recently? If it's true that negative emotions are discussed more in your circle of friends, I'd expect those to come to mind faster in a recall test than emotions that you haven't had to name. Another of the many areas Baumeister talks about that I'm going to comment on is to do with child development and research on the relative causal contributions to a child's IQ, which is affected both by heredity and by the parent's educational level. Now, biomass, the summary after a more detailed argument is that whichever of those factors is low is the one that seems to have more effect and fails to cancel out the other one. But that just means Baumeister is presupposing, without the slightest evidence or even stating his assumption, that somehow they ought to add. Now, if you try hard enough, you can find cases where things add, but there are even more cases where things don't add up. So, for instance, if we think about basic vitamin theory, we all know the point about vitamins is quite a long list of micronutrients, and you need all of them. And it's no good thinking that taking 10 times more vitamin C than usual will somehow compensate for vitamin B12. It's not like that. So many things are fundamentally like that. You need all of a set of things. Missing one is what damages you. And in that sense, that's fundamental to that causal setup. It's nothing to do with psychology. It's not that people have a weird bias. It's just the fundamental truth about many causal situations that all the conditions are needed for it to work. So if you think about something as simple as a balloon, is it leaking or not? There must be literally 100,000 places it could have a pinprick in, and every one of them mustn't actually have a pinprick in, or the balloon won't hold. And that's just how the world is in lots of ways. It's nothing to do with a bias. So it's easy to think, for the case of the IQ a child eventually exhibits, that it might need two things, both a home environment with well-educated parents that tends to bring out IQ, and the genes, the genetic heritage that makes that possible. And that would really be a quite common developmental case. There are many faculties that need not just a genetic endowment, but the right provision at critical periods. Another area Baumeister reviews is about stereotypes and people's tendency not just to use stereotypes, but to be more influenced by, to produce more negative stereotypes than positive ones. And it's similar in the area called impression formation, about how people form judgments about others who initially don't know, and then they get a few facts, and often in those situations, negative facts are given more weighting than positive facts. But I think what that argument doesn't say, doesn't take account of, is the need. So if I feel well endowed with friends, I don't really need new ones. And, you know, I might think on some sort of general principle I ought to be nice to new people, but the fact is I don't need them. When I go to a new situation, as I have a few times in my life, I'm really keen to make friends because I need them. And it makes me much nicer to them, much less likely to pick up on negative cues, much more likely to pick up on positive cues. So I think those things are not taking that into account. And in fact, when you see the worst cases of bigotry, it's almost always associated with groups who feel, say, their employment is under threat from immigration, and they become much more vehement and bigoted against other groups because they're under threat themselves. Whereas the opposite is true when you need it. So you certainly don't see that study being extended to whether a baby looks at its mother or forms a bad impression, or indeed probably a new employee is much more likely to form a good impression on their boss unless they're so self-confident they feel they can change their job at any time, in which case maybe they would be that choosy. But again, I'm suggesting it's strongly modified by the need of the person in assessing others. Some of these studies about impression formation have been deliberately been in situations a bit like people making hiring decisions about who to employ. But again, I suggest that as the economy cycles up and down, there are situations when employers are desperate for new people and situations when they're anything they're desperate about is how to choose one out of the 1,000 applications. Obviously, if there's a glut of applicants, employers can be very choosy and they can afford also to be very careless in their selection, because there'll probably be many well-qualified people. But if they have to wait 6 months to get a single application, they're likely to be much more careful about not forming negative impressions. So, I've been trying to group these slides a bit more under the nature of the various counter-arguments. So one of these is about ceiling effect. So if you picture someone who has everything, how could they possibly see any new thing as good? And in fact, it is hard to give a present to a very wealthy person. Because they've already bought for themselves everything and you couldn't afford the extra luxuries like a Premier League football team or whatever it is the billionaires really spend their money on. And also, for someone who's hungry, food is good, but if you're full, it doesn't make an impression. So in other words, a lot of this stuff about what counts as good and bad is relative to whether you're almost at ceiling, almost as satisfied as you could be in that way, in which case you're unlikely to see any strong positive feeling. Second one, thing about need. So another way of putting the example is, suppose you, as you soon will be no doubt, making lots of job applications. What's more important to you? Do you feel more devastated by the 4 rejections or feel positive because at last you've been offered a job? It just depends on, at least I think it largely depends on what your need is going to be, whether it's the good or the bad that make an impression. Of course, some of us are so emotionally fragile, we're devastated that not everybody offers us a job, but those who aren't quite that sensitive, it depends on your need a lot, whether it's a positive or negative that carry the important message for you and have a big effect on you. So this is about the difficulty in knowing how to compare things that have some intrinsic sense of equal goodness or badness, and I'm suggesting that one angle on this is about whether it expands your choices or not, and that comparing money to injury doesn't have that property, and more to the point, losing £1,000 when £1,000 is all you have is quite different from gaining £1,000 when you already had £1,000. It's the same amount of money. Simple-minded arguments think money is a measure of value, but actually it's relative to your need that makes a lot of the difference there. So I mentioned the vitamin model, which is quite wide. There are many situations where fundamentally bad drives out good, not because of psychology, but just because that's the setup of the causes, where one defect ruins a whole lot. But the complement of that is when you think about when you only need one and many have been offered. So I call that a warehouse because, you know, if you're after, let's say, the latest Apple tablet, and there are 100 in the warehouse, you really don't care whether there are 100 or one there, as long as there's one for you. Or to put it another way, if I've been optimistic about my walking strength, need to get down off the mountain, I really don't care how many empty wrappers there are, as long as there's one that has an energy bar in it. It's having the one is much more important than having 99 disappointments. Or similarly, to go with floods, which have been in the news so much in the last few months, it really doesn't matter much how many roads are blocked. The question is there one that's still working to get you out of where you are? And that one good will outweigh, almost completely outweigh all the bad. So that's the other kind of causal situation where anyone will do, but you must have one. So depending how you count, there's three or four generic arguments which I like for resisting Baumeister's arguments. Perhaps you might like to take a couple of minutes, discuss with your neighbour whether you nevertheless think Baumeister's impressive looking arguments are what you're going to go with, or whether my tremendous reasoning has made any impact on you. Yep. I'll have a go at that, yes. Thank you. Would anyone like to share a view publicly, or shall we move on? Any strong points? I think perhaps rethinking about this today, this is the one area where I feel that psychology would be better if it more often worked hard on a definition of functioning independent of psychology, so that it could compare our actual psychology with some defensible ideal. Often that's not necessarily important, but I think here perhaps it is. Right, so I'm going to move on to simplifying your life. The Ben Shahar textbook is where I got that from originally. It's also talked about in the Bonniewell paper, and there's a past wiki though. It's I need to work on restoring more of its text, but that talks about it a bit. So what's the proposition? The proposition is that to be happier we should simplify our lives, that too often people today are rich in goods, rich in money, but poor in time, and that this doesn't in fact make for well-being and happiness. It doesn't apply to everyone all the time, but it does seem to apply to a lot of people today. So some of the symptoms are feeling rushed the whole time, not having time to stop and talk to people, no time to catch your breath, let alone reflect. You certainly see this with tourists. They drive past spectacular scenery, but they can't look at it because they have to look at the road. You hear an interesting remark, but you can't start a conversation because, you know, if the lecturer starts up, you have something else to do. You can't digest things and pay attention as it happens. When something unexpectedly good happens, don't have time to relax into it. No time to taste your food, just swallow it while walking down the street. No time to talk to your family because your phone's beeping or you have to deal with your boss's email or whatever it is. And so on and so forth. So that's sort of the sketch of the symptoms. Actually, could we have a quick set of hands? First, who thinks they are more rushed than their life is too complicated compared to what they'd like? Right, and who feels they've got their life, on the whole, simple enough? Yes, one, two, three, very good. We'll ask you in a few minutes what your secret is, because you're in the minority here. So, the sort of remedies that are suggested is about cutting out chunks of what you plan, so as to leave plenty of time for the ones that matter. In other words, you do priorities, and then the difficult bit is what you're going to drop. Include time for the unexpected, both good and bad. Contingency planning is what they call it in professional project planning. Actually allocate time for just musing. Stop filling every minute of your time in advance. Yes, so overfilling definitely means planning in a way that prevents flow. So why do so many people overfill their lives? Well, avoiding boredom. I certainly have a strong fragments of memory about being bored as a child, even though compared to many children, I had what psychologists would regard as a rich as well as a comfortable situation. Whining to my mother, saying, what can I do, having not the imagination to fill it? But since I went to university, that's never occurred again. I can be unhappy, but I've never run out of things to be interested in. But I do think some of my habits are a bit laughably about not being caught out even for 30 seconds without something to amuse me. I'll always take a book with me on a train, or if I have to sit in a waiting room, I couldn't possibly just be in the moment, or at least I couldn't possibly have to rely on being in the moment. So I think that first point applies to me at least quite strongly, is ridiculously over worried about being bored. Another suggestion is some people are over focused on hygiene goals or avoidance goals, I think Pentridge would call them. That is, some of our goals about things we want. I want to be, you know, other side of Glasgow to go to a movie. That's a goal which is measured by whether I get there. But other goals are about avoiding bad things. hence the hygiene term. And although they're obviously functionally quite important, they don't seem to be associated with you feeling happy. You're just worried if you fail to achieve them. They don't actually make you feel satisfied when you do, particularly. I don't know how widespread this is, but I certainly think to a lot of people, to some extent, feel they have to have a plan, and then they go on to an unjustified corollary that they should only do what they have a plan for. I don't know. Any of you feel like that, or conversely, any of you quite sure you're not at all like that? I think it shows up. I think the test case of this is often holidays, about whether you end up with a tremendously planned schedule that then has no room for spontaneity, or on the other hand, whether you're entirely relaxed about going with the flow, as they say. I think it's linked a bit to the issues that gratitude bring up. That is, one aspect of gratitude that may be most important for our well-being is acknowledging to ourselves that we're not in control of everything, that some of the good stuff that happens to us isn't because we're all powerful and worried enough in advance and so on. It's actually, we enjoy it even though we didn't cause it. And that, I think, over-planning is associated with being too set on the bits that we do control. At least, I think that's probably a connection from this to other bits, other things that have come up on this course. I don't know about you, but I certainly think at times I've not paid attention to contingency time. So, for instance, like quite a lot of people, I used to be, on the whole, have a bit of a tendency to be late for meetings, particularly late with the people I like the most, but therefore I'm the least frightened of. And I sort of noticed this, and really that was about realizing that, you know, even walking to a room across campus, not going to have complete correct prediction of how long it will take. If I actually want to be on time, I need to have some slack allowed, or I'll be habitually late, as so many of my friends and colleagues are. And I certainly, on holiday, but also in some other parts of my life, I think, have sort of gone to think that a plan isn't a total prediction of actions. It's a framework for organising activity, but only a framework. And I think that's important, actually, and perhaps this is so obvious to most of you, but I think there are many of the things we most want we can't have a direct functional plan for. So, classically as a teenager, desperate for affection and sex, but what can you do about that? Sort of yelling for it or asking for it, it seldom works directly. So you do all these indirect activities which you think, pretty much correctly, will raise your chance of getting there. But there's a gap between what you want and can act on directly versus what you want but have to go about it indirectly, and that's quite like this idea of having activities that will structure your time, will tilt things in your favour in the long run, but you've got no way of guaranteeing it. You don't know when you'll stumble on big success in one way or another. And that's true of careers as well, since things evolve so fast that what employers will need in 10 years' time, no one has much idea of now. So if you try and plan a career at all, it can only be in terms of putting yourself in a direction that is more likely than not to be good in future, even though you, like everyone else, doesn't really know what the future will be like. You can at least avoid careers which are clearly contracting. So what a bad idea to go into a bank and be a bank teller where they're being slowly replaced by machines, and that contraction means you'll always be underpaid and miserable for the foreseeable future, versus going into something that's expanding, maybe, I don't know, eviction bailiff or something like that. Or if that doesn't suit you, you can think of other things that are expanding. And even though you don't have a precise career path, you can see that some are likely to have you ending up with the skills that will be wanted in future as opposed to less and less wanted. Now, it's not a well-written slide, but there is an aspect of learning, certainly learning at university, that definitely brings this out. So, from a plan-driven view of life, there's a paradox in some learning. So, a student who understands something 90% and there's just a bit missing is able to ask a precise question. They're more likely to have the confidence to do it, and they're much easier for people to answer, so they're much more likely to get what they want, and that's because they almost understand it, they're clear about the bit they don't, they can express it well, it can be answered soon. But a student who needs help far, far more than that one, a student who hasn't understood what this is all about at all, can't even articulate the question. They're in a very poor position then to get help actually when they most need it. So how do they get help? Well, if they have a bit of luck, it will be because they have situations where they can ramble on about their problem without feeling they're being a burden to those they're with, but something good may come out of it. So it's nice to be able to bend the ears of your peers in the class, and it's most nice when you haven't really understood that you have a question, you just hope something good will come. And it may, provided there's that relaxed atmosphere. Of course, if all your friends are ultra workaholics, they'll say, if you don't come to the point in 5 seconds, I'm afraid I have to do more homework now. And, you know, that won't be the situation in which an unfocused person can pick up what they need. This, I kind of first heard this and understood it some years ago when talking to a very senior university person. He mentioned his time as dean of, I think, the vet school, was it? The dental school. And he said that even as a dean, when of course he had unpleasant piles of admin all the time, he said how important it was to have an open door policy. And by that he didn't mean a theoretical invitation to students to interrupt him. He meant literally having his office door open, because he said that students most in trouble couldn't bear to start a conversation, or could hardly bear to start a conversation, and the slightest barrier would just put them off more. It had to, you know, hover in the corridor, be invited in, allowed to witter for a bit till they could bear to indicate what their problem was. And that's on a small scale, sort of a advisor of studies kind of scale, an issue of this paradox about having unscheduled time, not having an overcrowded life, not even an overcrowded work life, can actually be important for some functions where planning doesn't help. And in fact, you've probably heard already how that tends to apply with doctor's appointments, with GP appointments, where apparently a really common thing is a woman brings her child in with a runny nose or something, spends the length of the appointment talking about the child, and just as she's walking out the door and has already run over for a bit, she finally gets around to mentioning something the doctor realizes is the real point of the whole visit, which is her depression or whatever it is. So this kind of difficulty with an overplanned approach crops up in a number of contexts. So what's this topic of simplifying your life about? Well, is partly about prioritizing things and then scheduling ample time for that rather than the minimum time if everything goes right. And that in turn entails abandoning some of the things that you normally make time for, but which are actually less important. We might want to interpret it as time for meditation or reflection or mindfulness, however you want to put it. In other words, for processing what's happened rather than an over-focus on actions. And I think I'll just mention things which may be partly related to this. So first of all, as a student wiki some few years ago in this course pointed out that this is a precursor of this is monastic vows, because of course chastity, obedience and poverty are radical simplifications of life. To me, more insightful is the Franciscan way of life. So Buddhist monks apparently have a tradition of begging for their food and doing that every day, and that's also essentially what Franciscan friars did. Now, I wouldn't have either, probably wouldn't have known, certainly wouldn't have grasped the importance of this if it hadn't been for something that Peter Owen Jones said. He used to have some programs on TV. He's a Church of England vicar, but he's very interesting in his approach to religion. And one of the things he did for a short period in his life, because he has a very small rural parish, was to try and live in the Franciscan way for a while, which meant not earning money and then buying food, but attempting to barter things. And one of the observations he made about that is that meant he was required by this, therefore, to have daily social interactions and meaningful ones that were about exchange of labour value between people, and that how that did, in fact, although it, my instinct is I can just feel my stomach curling up with the uncertainty of it all, but actually it meant he was more socially embedded. He had interactions that were mostly positive with his neighbours nearly every day because of that. So I think that's interesting to bear in mind. Also, of course, it isn't just big organised religions. There are modern things with some things in common with that, crofting various forms of self-sufficiency. Actually, one feature of those lives is there's a way in which they're much more complicated, probably, than the typical urban life, and another way in which they're simpler. So they're more complicated because most crofters or self-sufficient people have dozens of different activities they do in a year or even in a week. It's a more complicated life. Rather than being a specialist at one job, you work in the factory, bring the money home, spend it. It's more complicated in that sense, but it's probably simpler in the sense of the number of people you interact with, because that sort of either a tiny community or a Franciscan way of life, these are personal relationships. So you interact with people personally, whereas our experience living in a city is, however many friends you have, you in some sense pass, interact, dodge on the pavement with many more who you have absolutely no relationship with in the usual sense of relationship. Certainly, you work in a call centre, you speak to dozens of strangers a day. It's a different complexity, and it's possible that well-being is more associated with fewer, deeper social relationships, even though that might be more complicated activities and skills. In other words, the opposite of Adam Smith's basic arguments about specialisation of labour. This also may possibly have some relationship to Zimbardo's theory about time perspectives. Zimbardo suggests there's individual differences in the relative attention a given person puts on the past, the present, and the future. So there tend to be characteristic differences in emphasis, and their difference in the amount of well-being associated with them. And that too is related to the famous marshmallow study with children about whether they could delay gratification or not, which is one version of how much they're able to think about the future as opposed to right now. And in the follow-up to that marshmallow experience, that is interviewing the same children 10 years later, those who did well on the delayed gratification seemed to be happier and more successful, and the others were still wrapped up in envy and poor instantaneous reactions to where they were now, as opposed to comforting themselves about how things would be in the future. So perhaps so perhaps you could just do this discussion activity next. Jot down your answers first and then discuss with your neighbour.
Okay. I'd be particularly interested in hearing from the two or three people who said they didn't really have any problem in this area and their life was comfortably simple. About what you do that's different. Were you one of them? Anyone else who feels they have a simple enough life? No? So, what did other... So let's start with you then. What did you feel about this discussion in general? Do you think you have time to think over what's happened, or get cut off, let it fester? Okay.
I was sort of the opposite in one sense, but I tend to, like, I fill my life, but I do it in a sort of spontaneous way. So, like, I'm always doing something, I don't really have time to sit, but because I'm good at finding things for myself to do, productive things in the moment. So I might not know what I'm doing when I wake up, but by the end of the day, I'm quite 100% busy.
But you're not oppressed by having this agenda you have to fill, you just fill it as needed.
Yeah, I'm not really good at keeping appointments, but I don't try to.
You're here. More can be said for nearly half the class. Okay. Someone in the middle? What are you?
We actually started talking a wee bit about how people got lots of talks in front of us about liking the technology that we tried to use. And sometimes that does work, but then kind of I got it and I thought in the last semester and it was meant to make everything a whole lot simpler. It would crash and cash was really included. Touchscreen and that's just really not worked because probably about an hour ago I was just getting really, really annoyed at it because I had too many things open and I couldn't find what I was looking for. So yeah, so that was where we went. And actually we were all talking about how satisfying it was just going through the tabs that you don't need anymore and just crossing things off. That was really ridiculous.
Uh-huh. Anyone else? Right. So, I'm going to now try and give you a perspective I learned from Phil Hanlon, who's recently retired, but is a professor of public health here. His introduction to this is a public health perspective, so this is about looking at life expectancy in Glasgow. What he's working up to is that these days life expectancy is pretty low in Glasgow, and that the reasons that used to seem the most likely explanation to do with poverty and industry don't any longer explain the discrepancy. So the search is on for a different hypothesis to explain differences in life expectancy. So certainly the general shape is, as in the last nearly 200 years now, there's been a huge extension in life expectancy generally. From a public health perspective, Hanlon suggesting their series of waves that have done it. So the first wave really was the classic interventions of fresh water and sanitation. In the UK, that came in during the 19th century and made a huge difference to mortality rates. Second wave, more to do with scientific rationalism, because one of the interesting things about sanitation and water was the theory the big Victorian reformers had was in fact entirely wrong, but their actions were entirely right. They thought it was about miasma, some sort of gas that came off bad things. They didn't understand that the disease was actually carried in the water that people drink. Nevertheless, installing sewers made a massive difference, especially first in London, but also elsewhere. So the second wave had more to do with science, and in the first half of the 20th century, vaccines began to have an impact. Probably important to remember that hunger was essentially abolished in the UK only during that period. So, although it's not much remembered, several thousand children in England died of hunger in the first half of the First World War because the government believed in free trade. Shortage of food as the army bought it up, and that partial blockade reduced food imports. If you have a free market, that means the poor start to starve immediately as the prices go up. Halfway through the war, they introduced rationing, and since then, very few deaths from simple starvation. So in the Second World War in Britain, the civil service already and politicians already knew what the answer was. They introduced rationing right at the start. From a public health perspective, one of the interesting things about that is although that made the diet a lot less agreeable for middle-class people, the poorest 10% of the population were actually better nourished after rationing was introduced than before. And hunger, of course, if it's at all serious, tends to have a significant impact on death rates because your immune system needs fuel like everything else. If you're starving, you're less and less able to resist disease. Third wave was as the welfare state really bit in. But now, the focus now is on public health initiatives to prevent disease rather than to and prevent it through changing behaviour more than anything else. So probably the lead on that was the establishment that smoking had this massive link to death. First important study, I think, was 1950. And although it's been slow and gradual, that has definitely changed behaviour in the UK and in many other societies too. So the first study was actually of doctors, and I think one of the things that was impressive about it wasn't just that it showed the enormous correlation between smoking and death from lung cancer, but once it was published, the large majority of doctors stopped smoking immediately. When doctors believe in their own prescription, that's when you start paying attention. So, let's say in the 1940s, 50s, well over half the male population was smoking in Britain, and now it's down to something like 20%. So that's sort of the focus of the fourth wave. But so Hanlon's question to his own field is, what could be the nature of a fifth wave that would then add further extensions to, well, reductions to mortality and morbidity? So one place to look for clues would be inequalities between areas. So there's some differences between genders, there are large differences between post code areas, but there are also differences between countries. So this is about post code areas in Scotland, and you have to realise that's a false zero on the left, but all the same, these are big differences. So the worst constituency, the expectation of life is an enormously worse even than the average, let alone best constituency. So the question is, can the causes be identified and then some sort of perhaps rather different style of public health initiative begin to address that? And that's particularly, and particularly part of this argument is that poverty is very strongly associated with different expectancies of life and has been for a very long time, but that is probably no longer a driving, or at least you can measure it, but it's no longer a really big factor. This is about measures of life satisfaction, but you should read the small print. That horizontal scatterplot graph is the percentage of very happy. So this isn't about whether when you're unhappy money might make you a bit more happy. It's more about the difference between happy and very happy is really not predicted by money since 1960 or so. There are, or have been to very recently, differences that depend on the economy. But the question is, what's the cause of poor health in Glasgow? So apparently it's possible to match Glasgow in many ways to one or two other cities in Europe. That is, Glasgow is characterised by having had massive expansion from industry and then the collapse of the core industry, shipbuilding in Glasgow's case. But you can find other cities that have had a comparable history at a similar time but now have a markedly different expectation of life. So the question is, what is it about Glasgow? And one hypothesis, if you care about these things, is that Glasgow has a particularly poisonous culture of some kind. And if you want to read about that, Carol Craig wrote this book making that argument. So in other words, there are features of behaviour that which can be culturally carried on, which are perhaps associated with what are now rather large differences in life expectation. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of Phil's ideas. This website is still active. There should be a link from the course page, or you can just Google after now and you probably get straight there. Exploring, I think, some ideas about what one might do in this area about changing culture, increasing well-being, and hoping that that will increase life expectancy along with that. So here are a few groups, long quotes from focus groups, really. Not unrelated to the Simplify Your Life theme, of course, that one. So the view being explored here is that materialism, consumerism and so on are both reinforce each other and lead to a lifestyle low in well-being and perhaps therefore low in health. And succeeding slides are linking this to different things such as sustainability, about whether the culture we ought to be trying to create for ourselves and our neighbours should have elements not just of science but of ethics and aesthetics. Different illustrations of this argument. So Hanlon's exploring and on that website is representing various talks and papers about the elements he's arguing need to be put together to create a healthier culture. Probably I failed to control. Oh no, that's more legible up there than it is on the small screen. I haven't brought slides for this, but I think I'll mention an area which would fit right in here. There's been a few student projects in the department in the last couple of years on what I think of as green space effects. That is, the theory is weak, but there's some real empirical effects that have been replicated. So. For instance, there was a paper some time ago that showed that patients recovered from surgery significantly faster if they were in a ward whose window looked out onto a green space as opposed to a blank wall. It's been shown in schools in Scotland by students in this department that if primary school children are taken out of the school, walk to a green space nearby, spend their break there, they're able to concentrate on learning much better in the significantly better in the afternoon after that than after a break either in the playground or indoors. And that was done in a school within walking distance of here, and then the year after a student of mine replicated that in a rather different school in a more rural area in Lothian. The first study, this depended on teacher judgments. They were quite clear about this, but that's different, of course, from showing a higher test scores or some other measure. the second study attempted to control for the amount of exercise, because exercise, as you know, has all sorts of effects, not only physically but on well-being. And we wondered if simply walking to the green space was just as important as the green space. But controlling for that, that was quite clear. The exercise that was carefully judged to be the same as what they did walking to and fro and running around in the green space was gymnastics run by the head teacher. Of course, those are quite different from self-efficacy, but they were approximately equalized for exercise. So I think that gets us a little closer. But the fact that a lot of this literature waves its hand and says green space doesn't tell us whether it's the color green and we can just paint the walls, whether it's really about plants, or something else. So there's a huge amount of future work needs doing. But I think, actually, a bit like the student here who talked about having a dog, having a pet and looking after them and so on, I think it may be a bit similar to that, because my take so... Oh, sorry, I should say I had another student who ran this on undergraduates like you, took them for a short break in Kelvin Park, as opposed to letting them sit in a room and amuse themselves as they wish, and got a just about significant effect on increased well-being from the park versus amusing themselves. And that has the nice quality that psychologists like so much in showing that participants don't know what's good for them, and that's what and they should do what the recipe is. Anyway, long way from identifying the causal factors there, and whether green is a good summary for that. But my current guess for the next wave of experiments would be that there's something for most of us in a green space like a park about. There's always something to watch. If there's any birds or animals, there's things that move. It attracts your attention, but it doesn't grab at it. And certainly, I think the thing I find most mentally relaxing is, although I quite like walking, but perhaps my favourite thing is sitting in a train looking at the scenery outside. And the thing about that is it's always moving. I can't possibly be bored, but on the other hand, my attention isn't snatched, so it's up to me to decide where my attention goes. And so what I'm thinking about is maybe the quality of these spaces is it's... in this area about not being over-demanded but not being under-stimulated, and you feel that you're freest there. If you have thoughts that need processing, you can do that. If you are entirely calm in that and want to think about something new, you can do that. So I think a lot of walks like has that, but also watching the scenery in different ways. I should also say there's a experiment published by some researchers in Stanford which touched on this. They although they used different measures, they weren't primarily interested in well-being directly or happiness. They were interested in divergent thinking, which is often taken as a proxy measure for creativity, and they showed that both exercise and being outdoors on a green campus had independent additive effects on that. And they did a rather better designed experiment than some, because they crossed their conditions. So they had people exercising in the gym versus sitting indoors, and walking outdoors versus being wheeled in a wheelchair outdoors, to properly separate the exercise from the environment. And as I say, they got a particular effect there. Also, they showed that the effect was very short-lived. So if you get interested in that area, that's always interesting to know, because one of the hardest things in a new area is to get any sense of the time scale, and sometimes you assume without really thinking one kind of time scale, and only much later has it come in that you got the entirely wrong time scale. So they were pointing out that at least divergent thinking is something that lasted barely a minute beyond the end of the exercise or green space. Now, there's nothing wrong about that, but if you were kind of assuming it was an afternoon length effect, you'd take a long time before you realize you were out by two orders of magnitude on the effect. And in education, I've seen effects that ambush people's unconscious expectations the other way. So there's a set of experiments in education that I think are very important about peer interaction and how it helps conceptual development. And the surprise there is all the other way around. Teachers unconsciously think it's the activity that causes learning, and they unconsciously assume that means more or less on the spot. But actually, in these experiments, there was often no effect at the immediate post-test, but 4 weeks later follow-up tests always found a significant effect. So that would be a case where the timescale was much longer than was unconsciously assumed by many researchers before. But in the case of the Stanford and the Green effect, it's a very short-lived effect, which doesn't mean it's not important, but it completely changes your feeling about what interventions might eventually be of use in an applied setting. For instance, we can't give that advice at the moment, but if you were thinking of how could you devise a building or a room that would support academic work the best, you probably have to think about a set of microenvironments, and you walk from one position in the room to another to, you know, do a different interaction, and you move on from that, because you know, if you're writing, organizing an essay, there are times when you want divergent thinking to plan the overall essay, and there are times when you want to be really focused on just the paragraph. So you need to shift the abilities you're maximizing, and if these interventions are big enough to be worth doing, you'd have to be able to think not of taking out an hour for a lunch in the park, but of doing things on a much shorter time scale. I'll just say one other thing, that the a commonly referred to theory, though perhaps it's a bit overground to call it a theory, is attention restorative theory. So those particular researchers wanted to explain these effects on children having a break in a green space as restoring their attention. And that means having a sort of model that a person, or anyway a school child, has a limited store of attention after they've spent it on a morning's lesson. It needs somehow to be recharged. And attention in that context probably means the ability to focus on what you're ordering yourself to focus on. Because, as we all know, not just children but adults, if you get them on an activity they are addicted to, like video games, they have no trouble focusing for hours on end. So it's not true that we can't attend at all. This is more about whether you can direct your attention away from your inclinations and to something purposeful. Right. So, if you want to follow up Phil Hanlon's ideas leading from public health into the possibility that we should draw on positive psychology to design a culture which is promotes well-being, and probably promotes well-being in the positive psychology sense, but also would have effects on physical health in the medium and long term. I'll go on to another wee topic in a moment. Just a word on homework. We've got a meditation, dear oh dear. Meditation. Probably many of you have some familiarity with mindfulness. For those of you who have none, you might just like to look up a past student wiki, get a briefing, and then a vague idea about what it is and how widely it's been used. Increasingly, it's been used medically and in positive psychology. And then Rowan will talk about things in that area. During the next week, I'm hoping you'll be able to, most of you will produce critiques of draft wikis. I'll post the instructions for that in the next day or two. But the idea is that you would critique someone else's draft wiki and feed that back to them via the I'll create a forum for posting that stuff to on the Moodle. Right. I'll just spend a couple of minutes on this. In fact, we already had a spontaneous mention of it. First of all, actually, there's two pet topics, not one. The more common one is it good for the human? But people are more seriously animal-centered ask whether they should be applying well-being ideas to the animals. And there was one past wiki you can look up if you want to pursue that, except that I need to fix it. The more usual thing to look at, more people have more been published on whether or not it's true that pets are good for people, and if so, why and under what conditions. So there's a wiki page from a couple of years ago that's quite good on that. Also makes it plain that whereas some studies seem to show definite effects, that's not true of all the published studies. Right, so obviously one thought is that it substitutes for social relationships. More careful experiments seem to suggest it doesn't altogether do that. But I think what a student here today mentioned is more typical, perhaps, of the more reliable effects, which are it gives you something to do that is likely to take you out of doors, is likely to lower your heart rate, it's interactive, it's it structures your day. There's a lot of ways in which it's probably beneficial. Also, it's important probably for us, whether we like to put it like that to ourselves or not, to have projects, and there's nothing like something, some being you have to care for to give you a responsibility and make you do it. Some of you perhaps want to interrupt me. I'm just haunted by a scene I saw some years ago in an otherwise not very good movie, which was set in a rehab centre. And this rehab centre, it had a mixture of types of addiction in there. But its rule, which it attempted to force on them, was that they were not even to think about having a love relationship anytime soon, that they first had to demonstrate they could look after a pot plant for several months, then they might graduate to an animal, and they weren't to mess with a human until they demonstrated they were able to care for them. I sometimes think about that. Think about that, yes. Re-qualifying for a basic human relationship qualification. I'm just going to mention some unscientific thoughts in that area, though, because I'm going to articulate something that made a big impression on me, but I don't know how to explain to myself or to you why it made such a big impression. A chap called Joe Hutto published a book called Illumination in the Flatwoods. He also had a documentary made about the same event, which is what first caught my attention. He's had a number of projects, but this was the first I'd come across, and it was he had bought a small bit of woodland in Florida, and he got a friend to get him some wild turkey eggs, which he then incubated, hatched, and raised the turkeys. And He, as you know, imprinting is now a long-established tradition. Turkeys are like that. First, more or less the first moving thing they see, they're likely to imprint on as a parent. Turkeys have to be cared for. They're not fed by their parents, but they're guarded. So they're sort of taken out to the woods with the large turkey fending off danger, taken back home afterwards. You know, lots of activity for a human. What was so striking to me that I can't, as I say, I'm not very feel able to put my finger on it exactly, but we clearly, it's a very long time since we had a common ancestor with a turkey, and yet when you saw this man, you know, so it's not like, so I think zoologists, for instance, have got quite a lot of theoretical papers and empirical papers about, say, dogs and humans, and the extent to which dogs have perhaps evolved with humans to be pets and were certainly pre-selected to fit in with us in a major way. It's very hard to imagine, but there's also rather a limited number of animals that have ever been domesticated. So against that background, it's quite odd to think of turkeys with a brain that would, you know, fit on the end of my thumb, from a very different heritage, with a very different lifestyle. And yet you see this man taking care of it, and he doesn't have to tell you what his emotions are, you resonate with them. And that's what made me think about how I don't hear this discussed, but it's as if there's, we have this capacity that is quite surprising given the mismatch. So, for instance, early on he was attending them, I don't know, 12 to 16 hours a day. He got them back into the hen run, the turkey run with chicken wire over it. He went indoors for 10 minutes to get a sandwich, probably the first time he'd eaten for 12 hours. He was back in 10 minutes, but a rat snake had got in through the wire and already eaten several of them. And you just know how awful he felt. He didn't have to go on about it. It's like parents whose child has an accident in the kitchen. You know they're never going to forgive themselves. There's nothing to be said about it. But it went on because as they got older, he'd take them out in the woods. One of the comments he made very interestingly, which is probably relevant to, or possibly relevant to green space theories, is he says he saw, or at least was aware of, far more wildlife in the woods than he'd ever been before he was with them. But he wasn't clear whether that was because a lot more predators came out to eye out the turkeys, or whether that it was walking slowly and continually watching them that made his attention quite different. But the other thing that sort of made me think about this funny emotional resonance was there comes a time when they're large enough that they can at last fly, or at least fly a bit. And so one day, coming back after another lazy day in the woods with his followers, instead of marching into the coop, one of them flapped its way up into a tree, and then all the others followed it. And they called down to him, but basically they were abandoning him, and you could just tell it's like a mother whose children have left home. Oh dear. So I think I'm mentioning this because I think there's a lot that isn't understood or even noticed about our interactions with animals, and how the most striking thing, actually, I think, is when you talk to people, is how almost everyone is completely confident that they understand the animal. That's particularly obvious with domestic cats. It's a real eye-opener when you read a book by someone who understands cats a bit better and you realise how completely most of us don't understand cats. But we feel we do. That's what I'm getting at. Why do we have this feeling that we can interact with them when there's actually no good reason for that, and when we don't feel that about a lot of humans, if there's anything faintly, you know, odd about them, we often feel we don't know how to interact with them, but we have this overweening and unjustified confidence with at least some animals. So, I just sort of mentioned that. So, I'm going to spend the last 5 minutes on this. There should be a link, and I'll make sure it's clearer in the next day or two, to Siobhan Lynch. Does mindfulness have anything to do with education? Well, it's been rolled out a lot in both schools and universities. This is an ongoing wave. And at least at university, the first thing to say is that mindfulness generally is quite good at reducing stress. Students often feel stress. If you feel stress, it certainly tends to obstruct your learning. So it's easy to understand one large effect. But Siobhan's looked at literature, and I think maybe some of her own work seems to suggest there can be a positive benefit on learning independent of anxiety levels. In other words, there's an additional effect that looks as if it might be there. So, that's the first point. Deals with anxiety, no surprise, that's a significant help. And so, as with the green space effect, but backed by probably a better literature, we're back with control of attention as perhaps a significant effect. Significant in the sense that it can be associated with learning benefits. So one of the things to think about and possibly discuss more next week is whether it should be rolled out, how best to do it, and so on. Could I ask for a show of hands, how many people have had some sort of mindfulness training? Who hasn't? That's about half and half at the moment, right. In terms of career, it's not entirely irrelevant, because as I say, this is a wave sweeping schools and also universities. So, one of the things Siobhan's concerned about is how to roll it out, given that she believes completely in the potential benefits, particularly in higher education. Also, she makes several critical points I think are worth bearing in mind if and when you tackle the mindfulness literature in general. One is that its biggest splash in the literature you have easy access to is in the medical literature, and they all quote John Sabat, or whatever his name is. There's one particular bloke who does it. He has one particular method, and medics being medics like standardization. They do all their experiments with the one method, and they regard it as heresy, or what they call unscientific, to consider any deviation from that. Now, that's all very well for accumulating results, but it actually probably means almost nothing is known about variations, whether there are better methods, and since methods are associated with cost, so for instance, a traditional thing would be an 8-week course where you perhaps go once or twice a week for 8 weeks and do homework as well. But in fact, many students' real practice is much more ad hoc than that, and they feel personally they have benefits. So this is clearly a very important mismatch between apparently beneficial private practices and the most published method. Furthermore, within the meditation world, as opposed to the medical world, there are many different voices about what the best method is, even if one could define best. So it's actually not true that there's one best method and that we can therefore start calculating the resources needed for a rollout well. So all of these are critical points to bear in mind, given that probably if you took anything practical away from this course, it should probably be exercise and mindfulness. I say that because best friend I had at school, eventually trained as a medic, came back with a cynical look on his face and said there's really only three things any GP needs to know: Valium, aspirin, and what the hell was the other one, penicillin. That three drugs accounted for almost all the treatment that a GP did. Well, as you're probably already becoming aware, exercise has huge amounts of benefits of all kinds, and therefore, just like aspirin, it's the kind of thing it's sensible to recommend without any kind of diagnosis, because if it doesn't make them better in one way, it will benefit them in another. And it has a very wide range of positive effects, and mindfulness is probably close behind it in its generality and apparent ability to make all sorts of different kinds of things better. So I'll just say that as a possible end note for the practical end note for the course. So next week we're getting Rowan to talk about mindfulness from a very non-standard point of view, and I'm planning at the moment to talk about the exam and how to prepare for it and give you some exercise perhaps on it. I'll post instructions for the wiki critiquing, but I should also say that you might get more out of exam practice in the next session if you've read as many different or at least read a variety of wiki pages from last year, if they're not enough from this year yet available, so that you've got some idea about topic areas and so on. Oh.